Tate Chronicles now transmitting.
Welcome to the Tate Chronicles on Healthcare Now Radio. And now, here's your host, Jim Tate.
Good day, citizens of the free world, from border to border, coast to coast, and to all the ships at sea. I bring you a warm welcome. This is your correspondent, Jim Tate, and thank you for tuning into the Tate Chronicles. Join me as we cut through the fog that exists at the leading edge of healthcare technology. My guest today is Jonathan Stoltman, who's the director of the Opioid Policy Institute. They address issues that impact people and communities affected by opioid addiction. Dr. Stoltman, thank you for joining the Tate Chronicles today.
Thank you, Jim, for having me. I'm really excited to talk to your audience.
You know, I am too. Last week, I ran across your report. It's titled The Digital Health Report 2.1, and immediately reached out to talk to you. To put it mildly, I was shocked by the findings of this report related to data sharing and privacy risk. So let's start with the report and its findings. What led you to investigate these different websites? I guess these are websites where people may go, maybe they Google them or something else, and they're looking for opioid information or treatment resources or things like that. And at some point, I guess you became concerned that there was not total privacy. Is that how this all started?
That's right, Jim. Yeah, and you're absolutely right that how a lot of people find treatment nowadays is they go to Dr. Google and they type in, you know, opioid addiction treatment, or I need help with opioids. And these are the services that pop up in that SEO. They have all those search terms and all that to really pop up very high in the search. So there was that, but I was also consulting for one of these services prior in 2020, sorry. And before that, I'd been for a decade an addiction scientist and concerned with primarily opioid addiction and drug use among pregnant people. And with that, just any addiction work, privacy is a huge part of it, including in the research community. So I've always been grounded in those principles, but I noticed in my time in West Virginia, when I was doing my PhD, that there is a lot of interest in these digital health approaches. Yeah. And so NIH and NIDA, which is National Institute on Drug Abuse, was really hyping up these approaches as, hey, this is a great way to break down some of these barriers to care. So I was, of course, pretty excited about that, which is why I started consulting for a company that was doing that work. And I thought, you know, this is going to be a really transformative way to get people access to care, because it is so hard, Jim, to get access to these services. But during my time there, I was really concerned with data privacy and just obviously because, you know, that's a big part of addiction treatment, like I said. And, you know, one of the things I was told was this is not a concern. Everybody's doing it. And so I put back on my researcher hat and said, well, let's find out. And so I started to do some research in this space starting in March of 2021. And I've been doing it ever since for the last 3 years. And it's been really scary to keep, you know, seeing these problems pop up, because it has been 3 years. And in that time frame, you know, thousands and thousands of more people are having their data exposed and really lied to by these services, as they're saying that they're private and secure and confidential and HIPAA compliant, even though they're shipping people's data all over the world.
Well, let's talk a minute about those. And I know you have the report is titled Digital Report 2.1, but I know this is not a final report. This is ongoing, where you monitor old, new, and upcoming websites that are collecting data.
That's right. That's right, yeah. Jim.
And so what type of data, first of all, I want to know what type of data they're collecting, and then what different technologies they're using to collect that data.
Yeah, that's absolutely right, Jim. We're doing ongoing research in this space, and the title is admittedly a little clunky with 2.1, but it's an extension of that report 2, where I was looking at 12 services. In 2.1, I branched out to add another 10. It's just a capacity thing. I'm sure I could do more, but it's just me doing this research, and it is a lot of work. So the more services, the more time, of course, and it's a very timely issue. And so when we're talking about what data are they shipping and what tools are they using to violate these patient privacy expectations, it's a little tricky to see exactly what data is going out from my end. The companies know, of course, or should know, because they had to install these trackers and pixels on their service and enable those services. So And I should note, even though they're in violation of the terms and services of those people who created the tools, they're still opting in to do this and violate these people's privacy rights. But all I can see is that they're doing it, that these services are, or these tools are engaged. And those tools are things like Google Analytics, like the Facebook Pixel, Hotjar, which is one that tracks, key logging and session recording. So basically it can track how your mouse is moving over the page, what information you're entering into forms, all sorts of really ugly stuff that you wouldn't want to be transmitted to a third party. And what so that's about, those are some of the things. Yeah, sorry,
about,
Jim, go ahead.
What about IP addresses?
IP addresses are likely included in that information. But again, I can't really look. I can't tell exactly what data is going on out there because I'm just looking at the website code itself.
Sure.
The only exception to that, Jim, is the Facebook Pixel. So what I did, and I didn't talk about it too much in 2.1, but I created a dummy Facebook account, a researcher account called Bill Wilson, Bill W., which your listeners might know.
Sure.
It was a famously proponent of anonymous treatment, right? And I visited the services, and in visiting the services, you keep open your Facebook profile, and then you can see what data is or what like services are talking to Facebook. And so in that case, I was able to see directly that some of these services were sending specific data to Facebook. I still don't know exactly what that data is, but it was tagged to my Bill W. profile, which means anytime that I'm then interacting on Facebook, Facebook knows that that profile is somebody either seeking drug addiction treatment or with a drug addiction, which is obviously a huge privacy issue.
Why are they gathering this data? How much of it is being done for commercial reasons to sell the data to some broker?
Yeah, it's not clear, Jim. I think that there is a business case for some of that stuff, and I really hope that that's not what's happening. I'll say when we see the data sold is actually more in bankruptcy. One of the services went bankrupt in the 3 years that I've been monitoring it, and they were one, famously Pear Therapeutics. They had a $1 billion IPO, and they flamed out within a year. Another one, Caden, also did a merger with another company, and the data was part of that sale, and that was in the press release. And then a third one, Sober Grid, the founder CEO had a very tragic accident, and the last I saw, the website isn't functioning. I'm not sure if the app is anymore, so it's not clear what's going to happen with that data, but there's a huge chunk of data, you know, tens and thousands of users that I'm sure that somebody would like to try to extract value from. So it's a really good point, Jim, but we can't really tell who's if they're selling it or not, but it wouldn't be surprising if they were.
Whether they're selling it or not, or somehow other ways it becomes available to somebody. I know there's a giant secondary market. So these folks that you're keeping an eye on, the data they gather may not be able to, even if you put in anonymous information, they can gather a certain amount of data, and that can be given, sold, hacked, or taken, and it can be aggregated with other data sources to really say, oh yeah, this is this person, and
exactly.
Then kind of go backwards, and so to me that's certainly a great risk, and I can only imagine how sophisticated those processes are to do that.
Yeah, no, you're right, Jim. And some of these things are even not that sophisticated. So like the apps, for example, a lot of them track location data and redisclose that. And so that's pretty easy then. Even if you don't enter your address into a form, they know where you are because they know where your phone's been sleeping, right? And so that's pretty scary. Those IP address questions, and then just directly entering many of them have forms that are intake forms. So I'm entering my name, my insurance company, my drug use history, my current treatment, if I'm receiving treatment, if I'm suicidal, depressed, any of those sorts of things that are highly, highly vulnerable and valuable piece of information on those black markets. So yeah, it's a really scary place, and that's why we like to try. And I think you're hinting at this, Jim. That's why we like to try to, you know, we would call for these services to be private by design. That means like when they are being created, they're minimizing data collection to reduce the risk profile. And then also, secure by design. So if they are collecting that data, if they do determine it is essential to know that insurance data, for example, for billing purposes, totally makes sense. But you also have to have really high security posture to make sure that that data isn't vulnerable to some sort of hack and available then on a black market. So our work really focuses on that private part right now, but the security part is so deeply intertwined with it. And it's a really, again, if they're not doing any of these privacy things, I'm really concerned what their security posturing looks like as well.
What visibility of this whole issue exists at the federal level? Is there any congressional movement to do something about this, or is any yellow flags or alarm bells going off? What have you seen?
There are. Yeah, no, there definitely are, Jim. We've had a lot of interest since we've started from the Hill on this issue. And it's a really complex issue. So I think it's just one of those ones that I thought I was very optimistic that, you know, boom, 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 where you just like start getting all this stuff done. But it is a complex issue. And it's one that like takes a lot of study and interrogation. I will say from a federal side, too, that there's a number of different players that could be involved here, which only adds to the complexity. So, for example, the FTC has done some enforcement on digital health apps like BetterHelp and GoodRx, which connect people to treatment. They haven't done anything in this space. We've been calling for them to be more involved with this population because it is so vulnerable and historically marginalized. And as you pointed out at the top, Jim, this opioid crisis continues to be a massive issue. And the ability to seek life-saving care is, you know, it's a matter of life and death for folks. And so we shouldn't expect folks to have to like read through 10,000 word privacy policies to understand if these services are exposing them to all sorts of really nasty things. So that's the FTC angle, but the NIDA angle too. They're funding those services, right? You know, there's a handful of them that they provide a grant support to accelerate their development. And, you know, we're really confused and scared that NIH and NIDA aren't doing privacy evaluations and audits of these services before they hand them taxpayer dollars.
Well, you mentioned NIDA, National Institute of Drug Abuse. There's some amount of allocation of grants that go out, I guess, to startups and other folks. What are the size of these grants? If somebody says, well, I've got this team together and we're going to put up a website and start offering education and links to resources or whatever it is, how large are these grants?
Can I get a little wonky on you, Jim?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So they're called SBIR, so Small Business Innovative Research Grants. Mm-hmm. And so it's a specific type of grant within the NIH structure. So a little different than those academic research grants that NIDA normally does.
Sure.
So the amount isn't a ton of money. So we're talking like in the order of hundreds of thousands of dollars, but there's a multi-tier process. So basically, if you get a first round grant, it increases your odds of getting that money down the line. And I think the highest amount that any of these services got was over $2 million total in grant funding. But it's typically anywhere from a few hundred thousand dollars to in the low few million dollar range. And so why that matters isn't actually the dollar amount, Jim. It's more that ability to put I'm NIH funded, I'm NSF funded, I'm NIDA funded on your service. Mm-hmm. And patients have no idea what that means. And most people don't, but other funders do. And so that gives a lot of credibility to the service as like one that's doing a good job because the federal government has indicated as such and given them grant money and support. NIDA also talks about these apps and services when they do press releases, when they do, they'll go to conferences and, you know, tote their investment in digital health approaches. So it's not something that it's not something that they just do like on the side. It's a really important part of their overall work. And then the last group of people that really care about those NIDA NIH funding brands or badges are providers. Mm. There's so many of these services out there that are trying to scoop up providers, and it's really hard to tell like who's actually legit and who's not. And so when you see something like that on the website, you're like, oh, you know, the federal government clearly thinks that these people are legit. Maybe I should make a referral for patients.
Sure.
And now I'm sending patients that's exposing their privacy to these services. And you can see how it creates this really terrible loop for folks. And then the last wonky wrinkle for you, Jim, is this money's also non-dilutive from NIH, which just means, of course, that it doesn't take any equity. And that is really appealing to those VCs, right? Sure. So they got a huge chunk of money, a few hundred thousand dollars to a couple million dollars that the federal government said, this is a person that's doing the right thing in this space. They're really great. This is innovative. This is cool. This is exciting. and they didn't take any equity. So when I come in to make a future investment, I don't have to fight over those equity shares. There's a bigger piece of the pie. So those are all things that make it really appealing. And again, it remains just absolutely shocking that NIDA, who knows better and who knows the privacy risks associated with seeking care, and the importance of that, did not consider the privacy risks with digital approaches. Even though there's, of course, other federal government expertise in this area, whether it's FTC or NIST or any of the other agencies, DOJ, that really understand those things. And they could have consulted before, you know, funneling out all this taxpayer dollars to these services that are hurting patients.
Let me speak to our audience just a second. If you're just joining us, I'm Jim Tate. And on this episode of the Tate Chronicles, I'm speaking with Dr. Jonathan Stoltman, director of the Opioid Policy Institute. When I was going through your website, I ran across and really fascinating information about the work you're doing to track opioid settlement money. So let's first talk about the sources of that settlement money. Where's that coming from? I mean, I know it's coming from Purdue Pharmaceutical, and I think it's coming from a bunch of pharmacy chains, correct? And where else?
Oh, it's huge. It's across basically every part of the chain that like touched the opioids during the opioid crisis is being held accountable. So it's all the way from distributors, so the folks that ship the pharmaceuticals to the pharmacies, to the actual manufacturers, so the Purdue's, the Malkindrits, all of those folks. Mm-hmm. And so what this is, you know, billions and billions of dollars that's going into our communities. And so as the opioid crisis continues to be a massive issue because of some of these bad actors in the space, we want to make sure that the money is spent on things that we know work and evidence-based approaches. And so a lot of what we do with the Opioid Policy Institute is try to help folks who are interested in trying to spend the money understand what those evidence-based approaches are, what are effective ways to treat drug addiction, especially opioid addiction. So how do you understand the problem? And making sure that the money is transparent, how it's being spent, and that folks can be held accountable for how the money's being spent. And so all that we mean by that is, you know, like the state of Michigan, for example, they're getting $1.6 billion over the next 18 years. It's a lot of money. And I like to say that if there's $1 billion, there's a billion different ways to spend it wrong. And so we need to make sure that, you know, it's done in a way that actually helps the folks that were impacted by this issue.
Are there any requirements on a state-by-state basis for how this opioid settlement money is spent?
There's two primary requirements. Mm-hmm. One is a document called Exhibit E. And mm-hmm. Exhibit E is lays out some of the areas related to like good spending. And so, you know, there's supposed to be some sort of legal binding nature there, but who enforces that is a big question. So again, for example, in Michigan, half of the money went to the state and half of the money is going to the counties. And so the money that's going to the counties is technically probably enforceable by the Attorney General office. But like, is the Attorney General office also going to investigate the state? That's not clear if they were to spend it inappropriately. And then the people who settled or resolved those lawsuits, like the companies, the CVSs, the pharmacy chains, the Walgreens, they also are charged with enforcing it, but you can imagine that they might not be all that dedicated or like put that many resources towards all that. So Exhibit E is the one thing. And then the other kind of term that is important or term of art is opioid remediation. And so that's a really gray area because that could cover anything from, you know, law enforcement to evidence-based medications and harm reduction supplies and stuff that we know that will help people, you know, on the ground today. So there are some guardrails, but I even hesitate to call them guardrails. It's mm-hmm. a pretty loose framework around it. And the reason for it was just to try to avoid some of the waste that happened with the tobacco settlement spending. But you can already see in many areas that the money is being spent in a way that is not in the spirit of Exhibit E. It's just the problem, Jim, is now like, when will enforcement happen? And yes. In the interim, people are dying every day because of this issue. So we don't really have time to waste for this spending.
You know, what the whole opioid crisis, there's so many aspects to it. One of which is, you know, we kind of have in our mind's eye definition or or what a addiction looks like. You know, somebody who has a long history of gateway drugs and, you know, whatever. I have seen people who have never been, you know, involved with any of this at all, that they broke their ankle, they were put on opioids, and they became addicted to opioids. So the addiction potential is and was massive, but also the push by big pharmaceutical companies to push this out there it certainly made billions and billions of dollars. But I'll give one example where Purdue Pharmaceutical paid a $1 million bribe to practice Fusion EHR so that opioids would be suggested as in the first round of treatment for people diagnosed with lower back pain. And that's not clinically proven, or is that based on the clinical evidence? But that, and Purdue Pharmaceutical was, I mean, this is all from the Department of Justice. They were allowed to create the clinical decision support rules that fired hundreds of thousands of times in providers' offices. Not only the addiction potential of opioids, but the push and the marketing and the profit behind it. It was like a perfect storm that was unleashed.
You're absolutely right, Jim. And, you know, when we think about these lawsuits across manufacturers, distributors, and pharmacies, there's a reason why that whole chain is being held accountable. And I think a lot of focus has been on those manufacturers because those are like big names that we're all familiar with now. Mm-hmm. But some of them are the CVS, Walgreens, and Walmart of the world are settling some of these lawsuits. McKesson, AmerisourceBergen, and Cardinal Health that are distributors, those are massive, massive companies. It's not just any one person or any one company. There's a lot of people that have been held accountable for the prescribing that was happening, and it continues to be an issue in some spaces. And that's really why this money is important, is we want to make sure that the money goes towards those people that were harmed by some of those deceptive prescribing practices or inappropriate prescribing practices that really help folks that have been impacted by those issues in the family and our broader community. When we think about drug addiction, we often focus on that individual with the active addiction. Mm-hmm. But of course, it's not just them that's experiencing the addiction. It's also their family members, their friends that are trying to help or provide support or resources that really has this ripple effect across our community. So yeah, I really appreciate you shining a light on that, Jim.
Well, I know the work that you've done. You got this ongoing dynamic website information where you update on a regular basis about, of course, you can't do all the websites, but you do a lot of them. Kind of fascinating to see the information there and how you're tracking the opioid settlement money. What do you see for the Opioid Policy Institute moving forward? More of the same, or are there some new initiatives you find yourself interested in this domain?
Yeah, thanks, Jim. So Opioid Policy Institute continues really to dig into these privacy issues because there's a lot of different ways that they can manifest. And so we're not giving up yet, even over the 3 years. And at the end of the day, we're definitely not giving up until we see some federal action in the space. So whether it's the FTC coming in or NIH NIDA having some different standards on this, there's just so many different stakeholders that we still need to see change their behavior. So we're going to keep digging in there. And we're also going to keep trying to help folks that are trying to spend that opioid settlement money. And we're really excited about that work. And it sounds like a long time. It's 16 years that money's coming in. So we can definitely have our work cut out for us. I do hope the privacy thing is resolved in the next day, even though I don't think it will be, of course. But those are some big things that we're committed to for the next few years.
You know, the settlement money, I know it's state by state basis. Maybe some cities individually are getting settlement money, are they?
That's correct. Yeah. So it's kind of distributed to the state, and then the states have agreements with the counties, cities, and tribal communities as well. Sure. It's really multifaceted, very complex. And the cities, you know, I'm in Michigan, so some of the cities, you know, are getting like a Detroit or Grand Rapids where I live. They're getting a pretty big chunk of money a year. But I live in a smaller part of Grand Rapids called East Grand Rapids. It's its own city. And they're getting $8,000 a year. And so I'm still really committed. It's my local community. I'm committed to making sure that $8,000 is well spent, even though it's only $8,000. So
sure.
we're trying to help. And I will say thanks for calling out to our Opioid Policy Institute website. All of the data that we do for our research is openly available. It's usually behind like a subscriber. It's a free subscriber. I mean, you can pay too if you support our work. It's a free subscriber. And that's just to like prevent those AI bots from scraping all our stuff and doing whatever the heck they want with it. So you do have to give us your email, but I promise we don't provide it to anyone else. And we just do it as a way to continue to have our data available for free.
And let me mention that's at opioidpolicy.org, opioidpolicy.org. Well, almost totally out of time here. I'd like to thank the audience for joining me on this episode of Take Chronicles. And I, of course, offer a special salute to my guest today, Dr. Jonathan Stoltman, Director of the Opioid Policy Institute. Dr. Stoltman, thanks for coming aboard today.
Thanks, Jim. And thanks for bringing this to your audience. And I hope you didn't lose too much sleep after reading the report. But I continue to lose sleep over this issue. So thanks for raising the awareness.
I'm still thinking about it, let me tell you. You can find more information on this show's program page at healthcarenowradio.com. That's healthcarenowradio.com. Until we meet again, here's wishing you smooth sailing and safe harbors.
Tape Chronicles transmission ending now.